For argument is 17-2570, Crumley v. United States. We're ready, Mr. Ennett, whenever you are.
Thank you.
This too involves some medical issues, but it's a completely different context, right?
I certainly hope so, because I was rather lost, and certainly a tough act to follow as well.
So why don't you just, it would be helpful to me if you could just spend really a few minutes just talking about the background of the facts here. We've read the briefs and we understand them. It would be nice to put this in context. What happened?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. As Your Honors are aware, my name is Matthew Ennett. I represent the appellant in this case, Matthew Crumley. Mr. Crumley is also present in court today with me. As Your Honors are aware, in this case, I just start at the end of the case, which is Mr. Crumley was discharged from the United States Air Force following a reduction in force board. We contend that that discharge is a direct result of what happened months earlier, which was that Mr. Crumley was disciplined for reporting a safety concern to senior Air Force leadership. Now, he did so by way of an email, which was sent 2 days after he fell into a grave while performing burial honor guard duties for a deceased member of the United States Air Force.
I can't place my finger on the email right now, but my recollection is it was less arguably a call to there's a safety concern you have to do something about, and more about, hey, I may be interested in suing the city of Cambridge. Who's going to help me file my lawsuit?
Sure.
So isn't that a fair characterization?
I don't think so, with respect, Your Honor. It's at Appendix 273, page 91 of this court's record. And I apologize for the copy. I'm not sure if the one that you have has the same line that I do. But in any event, what he's done is he's given a situation report to both his immediate commanders as well as senior Air Force commanders. I would note also that included in that email are the United States Air Force Safety Program. And if you direct your attention, if I may, to further in that email, what he states here is, and the entire part of the email goes through a description of what happened and the nature of his injuries. And then if you go to page 94 of the record, what he says is request counsel and advice to address this matter and potentially Air Force Safety, DOD General Counsel / Safety, State of Massachusetts Labor / Work Safety, City of Cambridge Law Department, Public Works, City Manager, Mayor's Office, and OSHA, Department of Labor, support to address this very serious incident that has caused great pain to me. He also in there his team members. So this is one of those situations where we're dealing with a real life incident here. We're not dealing with a carefully crafted letter from counsel addressing various statutory provisions.
Well, one of the suggestions here, though, is not exactly what he said, but who he sent it to. Why was it necessary? I mean, I'm not a member of the military, but I think we all understand chain of command is really important. And part of the rub against your client was that he didn't address this with his immediate supervisors, that he went straight to the top, and that appears to be something one does not like one to do when they're in the military. So what's the difference with that? I mean, why could he have not reported this up the normal chain of command?
I do agree with you, and as a former member of the Armed Services, you're absolutely correct that the military doesn't generally like people jumping the chain of command. But that's part of why Congress enacted and why there's a law, the Military Whistleblowers Protection Act, which allows service members to essentially do just that, which is to jump the chain of command where there's an issue that they are concerned about, that they are and they want to report it above their immediate chain of command. Mr. Crumley,
really? I mean, it didn't, if he didn't get any satisfaction at the immediate level, so that clearly he would be justified in saying, I didn't get satisfaction from my people, so I was forced to move up the chain. But in this instance, there was no such intermediate action, right?
I would submit to the court, Your Honor.
Am I right about that?
You are right about that, Your Honor. And I would submit to the court there's absolutely no requirement that you first direct this safety concern, this protected communication, that you first direct it to your immediate supervisor, and only then, when unsatisfied, go above him. I'm not aware of any such requirement in Air Force regulation or law that would require a soldier, an airman to do such a thing. And I would also point out to Your Honor that the Air Force has consistently maintained, we're not disciplining Major Crumley for that email that he sent. We're disciplining Major Crumley because he was allegedly rude to members of the 66 ABG Judge Advocate's office.
I thought it was conceitedly rude.
That's a gross overstatement by the government in this case, Your Honor.
Mr. Crumley's letters in response, I don't remember the exact date, acknowledge the inappropriateness of at least the tone of voice on November 22nd. At the JAG office?
No, I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor's interpretation of that, and I think the government's interpretation of that. If you actually read that, the letter that Major Crumley submitted, Major Crumley.
Do you have an appendix site for it?
Page 282.
Oh, thank you.
Yep.
What he actually says is that he takes full responsibility and ownership regarding his conduct/tone in the meeting in the judge advocate's office on 22 November 2010. He doesn't include any type of an admission there that he actually said something disrespectful or even had a disrespectful tone for that matter with Lieutenant Colonel.
And he then goes on to say, I feel absolutely terrible and have personally extended apologies to Lieutenant Colonel Allen, Captain Peeler, and have met personally with Captain Peeler recently. Please convey to his NCO my apology in making his NCOs feel uncomfortable in the meeting.
So I would submit
that goes quite a bit further than just saying I take responsibility. It acknowledges that he feels that he needed to apologize for making other people feel uncomfortable in that meeting. That would certainly, it seems, be some evidence to support the conclusion of the lower tribunal, which was that he had behaved badly in this meeting and that justified the action.
I would make two points, Judge Moore. The first point being that, of course, we're on a de novo review here. There's not a substantiating the lower court's finding, but this court should be looking at the evidence as a whole and reaching its own decision without deference to that. But the second point being there were three meetings, there were three ostensible meetings on that day. One had to do with the 66 ABG paralegal, which took place in a public location at the medical facility where Major Crumley was. The next was a meeting between Major Crumley and Captain.
So this says, I take full responsibility and ownership regarding my conduct and tone in a meeting in the judge advocate's office on 22 November 10.
Yes, and the...
And then the sentences right afterwards explain what he means by that. So I find it hard to believe that the sentences immediately after the sentence talking about how this is referring to the meeting in the judge advocate's office on 22 November 10 are nonetheless directed to some other meeting.
There was no communications with any paralegal in the judge advocate's office on 22 November. The communications in the judge advocate's office on that day were first with a subordinate officer, Captain Peeler, and then subsequently to that with a superior officer, Lieutenant Colonel Allen. The only communication that could form the basis for UCMJ, I would submit, would be the communication with Lieutenant Colonel Allen, disrespect towards a superior commissioned officer. If if raising your voice at a subordinate during a time of stress could constitute conduct unbecoming or some type of disciplinary action, then certainly none of the drill sergeants who I ever had at Fort Leonard would still be in the military, and presumably all of the commanders I've ever served under, as well as anybody in the military, would also have similar letters of admonishment in their files.
All right, so I just want to, you know, I hate to say this, but I don't totally understand the line or chain of command. So Captain Peeler and Lieutenant Colonel Allen, how are they in the chain of command relevant to Major Crumley?
They're not in Major Crumley's chain of command.
Okay, but okay, where does a captain or a lieutenant colonel fall compared to a major?
Sure. So just starting from captain, it would go captain up to major up to lieutenant colonel. So
okay.
Major Crumley
so
outranked Captain Peeler.
Now I get. That's what I was trying to understand, is who outranked who.
Yes, so Major Crumley outranked Captain Peeler, and Lieutenant Colonel Allen outranked Major Crumley at the time. The point here, or one of the points here, is that we don't, and to Your Honor's point, if you look at the statement that Major Crumley submitted to the IG's office, he actually details exactly what was said and what was exchanged between everybody, and that's the only record that we have, and that does not, I think what you have here is you have an airman accepting responsibility for his part.
I know it's hard. I'm raising three boys, and I tell them all the time, you know, apologize. And sometimes they apologize for things they didn't even do wrong because it's just their nature. And, you know, people, unfortunately, in the legal world, see an apology as an admission of guilt. And that's what, unfortunately, Mr. Crumley is suffering from with regard to that particular letter. He did the appropriate thing you would want an honorable man to do, which is to take some responsibility to apologize under the circumstances. Polite people do it all the time, even when it's not their fault.
And I think that's exactly the problem here, Your Honor, is that there was never any type of investigation done. We still don't know what it was that Major Crumley allegedly said or did to Lieutenant Colonel Allen that was disrespectful to the status that would arise to a UCMJ violation, which resulted in...
I gotta say, I'm raising a daughter, too. I have no idea why I limited that to three boys. Totally inappropriate. All of it also applies to her.
I have two, and I concur, Your Honor. We still don't know what it was that was said, and this is one of those rare cases, and we appreciate, certainly I appreciate, the broad deference that's given to the military and its personnel decisions. This is one of those cases, though, where the deck has been stacked against Major Crumley, and the full might of the United States Air Force has moved against him and resulted in this situation, which everybody seems to acknowledge is unfortunate and disappointing, but nobody seems willing to say what was done was wrong, which was that he was being reprised against for making this communication of a safety concern to senior Army leadership, Air Force leadership and safety officers. And the record also shows that, and this is getting back to Chief Judge Frost, to one of your points, the record also shows that Major Crumley received a call later from the safety office that had jurisdiction saying, thank you for your email, and we are going to initiate a safety investigation based on your report into these conditions. And that's in the record as well. So I think it clearly was a protected communication. There's been a lot of discussion in the briefing about the IG report. To be clear, the Inspector General did not conduct an investigation. The Inspector General declined to conduct an investigation.
Can I ask you just a related sort of, in your blue brief initially, you listed the fourth issue as being whether the adverse administrative action was procedurally deficient for reprisal against communications protected under the Military Whistleblower Act. The government comes in and says there's no judicial review of the Military Whistleblower Act, and I didn't notice off the top of my head any response in gray, and I don't know anything about the Military Whistleblower Act, so I don't even know if your client preserved any rights for filing a whistleblower case, etc. So could you just illuminate?
We're not seeking a. He's not making a claim under the. It's not an independent claim under the Military Whistleblowers Protection Act.
Would he have arguably an independent claim under that statute?
My understanding. And I'm happy to provide supplemental briefing, is that following the amendments that were done in 2018, retroactive to 2017. There's clarification that there is such rights, but I'm not in a position to tell the court how that would how that relates back to, say, 2012, when we're really talking.
So you haven't asserted a claim of a whistleblower or a whistleblower reprisal or anything like that?
No, it's not. It's not an independent claim of that. What it is that the decisions made by the various bodies, including the AFB-CMR, were arbitrary, capricious, and contrary to law. And one of the reasons for that is because this was a violation of the Military Whistleblowers Protection Act. So we're still continuing to challenge the AFB-CMR decision. We're not making a separate claim under the Military Whistleblower Protection Act. I hope that distinction makes sense.
Okay.
Because, I'm sorry.
Have we been notified on paper about this 2018 legislation that you mentioned?
I don't believe that you're. I don't believe that it's been briefed, and it's actually something I just happened to see as I was preparing for oral argument in the last several days.
And it was explicitly involved the Military Whistleblower Act? Because I know there's been other whistleblower legislation in terms of who's got jurisdiction over what.
Yes, and I also know that the case that's being argued after us, I believe, originated with a military, with a non-military whistleblower, but a whistleblower issue.
Right.
I'm concerned about making a representation of the court that I can't stand behind 100%. I don't want to do that.
I just wanted to double check.
But I would be happy to submit.
I didn't remember ever having heard about that.
Yeah. So I believe that it was amended recently to give jurisdiction a broader jurisdictional framework. But I don't think that it really impacts this case because of the timeline.
Okay, you've used your rebuttal. We'll restore your rebuttal on your
I'm terribly sorry.
Thank you. No.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I just want to hit on a couple of points from the appellant's counsel. You asked for recitation of facts, and he skipped, of course, the beginning of the facts, is that the service member fell into the grave, 2 days later sends his email. That email was immediately forwarded to the JAG office with Colonel Yike saying, let's see what we can do for this service member. Let's make sure he gets all the legal assistance he's in need of. I believe, Chief Judge, you mentioned that it sounds like the email is a request for legal assistance, and that's exactly how the Air Force read it. They read it as, something terrible happened to this man. Okay, let's forward this to the right office. Let's make sure we get him all the help that he needs.
Was he CC'd on that email? Was he aware that that was the action that was taken?
At the time, no, but of course he submitted a FOIA request to the agency prior to commencing his lawsuit.
Why wouldn't they tell him? I mean, it could have sort of ameliorated some of the incidents that took place afterwards if he had known somebody was paying attention to this and had forwarded it to legal assistant.
Well, I will. So the court asked whether or not he was CC'd on the email. He was not. However, he did receive a call from the legal office. Presumably that call was, hey, we heard that something happened. Seems like a pretty logical leap that the legal office heard that something had happened because the email had been forwarded to them.
Wait, time out. You said there was an email that said we should get this serviceman all the help he needs. And,
yes.
Right? Okay. He was not at all aware of that email. You said then the record reflects that the legal office called him. I'm not certain I understand that anybody testified or there's anything in this record about what was discussed at the call, but you just suggested that we should divine that something similar to what was in the email was conveyed to him in this phone call?
So what I intended to say was that based on the email being forwarded to the JAG office, Mr. Crumley received a call from the JAG office to set up an email to assist him with his legal rights. And so the record does not reflect that call specifically said, yes, we received your email, and we received it. However,
what does the record reflect about the call in particular? Because I feel like you're suggesting what you think may have happened in the call, but that's not reflected in the record.
I understood, Your Honor. If the court will just indulge me for a moment. A record at appendix page 569, which is one of the multiple times that the email from Major Crumley was forwarded, a Brigadier General Dwight Creasy says, sir, from a legal perspective, this is a legal assistance matter for Major Crumley and a potential claims issue for the Air Force. Naturally, there's a separate medical care piece. Lieutenant Colonel Allen, 66 ABGJG, is the point of contact POC. Skipping the next sentence, a legal assistance attorney contacted Major Crumley this morning and offered to provide legal assistance. And so it's based on that email in the record that it's our understanding that Mr. Crumley was contacted. Your Honor is correct that the records did not specifically reflect that they called him and said, yes, we've received your email, and that's why we would like to have this meeting. But the email was received, and that's why he was contacted, and that's why the meeting in the JAG office occurred.
And the email you just were reading from is 11:30 on the morning of the 22nd. His email is 8:40 on the same morning?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, and so pretty quickly the Air Force reached out to him and contacted him.
So what precisely was the conduct by Major Crumley about on which the agency, the government, based its decision to not reopen?
So he was reduced. It was a reduction in force pursuant to the 2011 national. There's no conduct associated with that. It's an involuntary separation. The 2011 National Defense Authorization Act ordered the military to separate up to 30% of its officers. And unfortunately, Major Crumley was included as part of that. There's the record and the actual discussions of the, it's called RIF, which is reduction in force. The actual discussions of the RIF board are statutorily protected and cannot be produced even in response to discovery requests by a court. And so we don't know, but this court has held in the Elfin case, which is a 2014 opinion, that the decisions of the RIF boards, reduction in force boards, are not justiciable matters, whether or not.
So I'm just curious. So I understand the facts that he was reduced, you know, or eliminated as part of a RIF that was broader than just himself, obviously.
Yes.
And he responded, I don't think that was the real reason that I was let go. I think the reason I let go was retaliation for my whistleblower claim. Why are we then down the road of whether or not he behaved badly in a meeting? You said that he wasn't let go because he did anything wrong. So I guess I'm just struggling with what his behavior in a meeting with one superior and one subordinate has to do with this case. I'm confused.
Sure. So it's Mr. Crumley's assertion that he was that it was retaliation for his conduct in, or for his email to
for his email, right?
But right, his email.
So why in the world are we sort of discussing or disparaging his behavior in the meeting that subsequently took place? What relevance? I don't understand what relevance that has to the government's claim that he wasn't removed for any reason related to his individual performance. He was removed as a general rep.
Right, so the government's response to this assertion that the letter of admonishment was put into his record as retaliation is, no, you actually did something. That was conduct that was that deserved the letter of admonishment. And we would note there's actually statutory authority. Just very briefly, Your Honor, there's essentially three levels of discipline within the military. The lowest level is three sub-levels, and so you can either get a record of individual counseling, letter of admonishment.
So just out of... I just want to make sure I understand something. Are we here, has he claimed that the adverse action that he's appealing to this court is the RIF or the letter of admonishment? Because I didn't understand us to necessarily have jurisdiction over a letter of admonishment. It's my understanding that we have jurisdiction to review adverse actions of a certain level of severity or higher, and a letter of admonishment would not fall into this court's jurisdiction. Am I right about that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if it's attendant to his claims about a RIF, is that true?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct. And so the question is whether or not the RIF board, and I would note that the members of the RIF board have to be completely separate from his chain of command. They have to sign an attestation. They have to remove themselves if they have anything to do with the person who's being considered for removal. And so
I just want to make sure that I understand you. So is it the government's position that this court does not have jurisdiction to determine whether the letter of admonishment was an appropriate, because that's an adverse action, surely.
Right.
Now, reprimand is an adverse action. So is it the government's view that this court does not have jurisdiction to decide whether that adverse action was appropriate or not?
So the court, the lower court, and of course this court in a de novo standard reviews whether or not there was substantial evidence for the agency to put the letter of admonishment in Major Crumley's file. And so the court has jurisdiction to determine whether or not the boards properly determined that there was sufficient evidence underlying the letter of admonishment to permit the letter of admonishment
but
to be
why,
put.
But you're saying we have no jurisdiction to review not just the RIF itself, but what they even looked at. So what are we supposed to do with the letter of admonishment if it has no, nothing to do with anything unless we can establish that that was one of the bases upon which the rift developed.
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe at the trial court level, the government did move to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction on the administrative record as a finding that the agency did have substantial evidence underlying the decision to put a letter of admonishment into the major's record.
But no link established that that has any relevance to anything, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So the view is that we can independently review a letter of admonishment going into his file for substantial evidence, but we have no authority, no jurisdiction to review.
So as I mentioned, the Alfin case in 2014 was somewhat similar. It was actually associated with the exact same 2011 NDAA and a reduction in force. I believe it was over 300 former members of the Navy who'd been involuntarily separated. And they asserted a variety, obviously 300 different members, 300 different stories. They asserted a variety of different issues, merits, procedural, so on and so forth. And this court found that whether or not the RIF properly occurred was not justiciable. And I should note, I just want to note that the RIF is not the end-all, be-all. There's three levels of internal appeal within the actual agency, in which the major was able and did actually challenge the decision of the RIF. He, of course, appealed to the Air Force Board for Correction of Military Records, appealed that denial to the Undersecretary of Defense, and then finally requested a special board before proceeding on to the Court of Federal Claims. The Court of Federal Claims has held repeatedly, and it's particularly in the Paskert versus United States case, which we cited, that a military member has no vested interest in actual continued service. And an instance here where he was involuntarily separated, but with an honorable separation, he wasn't given dishonorable or anything along those lines, he really has no interest outside of the statutory parameters that are set up within the agency to appeal the conduct that occurs.
So the Military Pay Act, which is the statute that the Court of Federal Claims judge found created a money mandating, was money mandating to support Tucker Act jurisdiction. Does this court, and did the Court of Federal Claims, properly consider whether the non-selection board could permissibly rely on the bad language, let's call it, at the November 22nd meetings that supported the letter of admonishment and then the file and in turn the non-selection board, or does one say, you just can't look at any of that because the RIF is the RIF and we can't look beyond it?
So we did assert at the trial level that these issues are not justiciable, that they're whether or not there was, we also asserted there was not jurisdiction at the trial level because.
You have not made that assertion here, right?
No, I believe we did not appeal the court's finding because they did find that they granted our motion for judgment on the administrative record, which, again, also was proper because even if...
Wait a minute. You thought there's no jurisdiction, but since they were finding in your favor, you decided to just, allow the jurisdiction anyway. Is that basically what you just said?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it might be.
Okay.
Yes. We did not appeal the court's finding of jurisdiction.
Right, but you had made a distinction between jurisdiction and justiciability, and you also did not make an argument in your red brief here that jurisdiction aside, there's a justiciability problem, and we really can't even look at the actual basis or the grounds for the basis of the ultimate honorable discharge.
Your Honor, I believe that we did, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe we did cite the Alfin versus United States case in our brief, which, again, is this court's 2014 holding that the RIF boards are not justiciable. However, yes, the crux of our argument was that the motion for judgment on the administrative record was properly granted by the trial court because even if this variety of procedural errors that are asserted by Mr. Crumley did occur, the actual conduct underlying it also occurred and the letter of admonishment was a proper action taken by the military. And I would note, essentially, the injury that he complains about is that this very low-level disciplinary matter I mean, again, this is, there's three levels. He could have been court-martialed. There's statutory authority that would have permitted them to court-martial him for speaking this way to a superior officer. Instead, he's given the middle level of the lowest level of discipline. In November 2011, the 2011 National Defense Authorization Act was not even published until January 7th of 2011. So this idea that there was some kind of retribution, as in...
I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but you speak a tiny bit fast.
Oh, I apologize,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Just a little bit.
Sorry. Apologies.
Can I ask you an absolute hypothetical, which is, what if a person in Major Crumley's position had sent to the highest chain of command, there's a real safety issue, and my supervisors aren't addressing it, and it's a problem, and people are going to get hurt, and you need to know about this. And what about, we all happen to know that people got angry with him because he didn't follow the chain of command. So it's really kind of a pretty much a classic protected activity under the Whistleblower Act. Under this Military Whistleblower Act, under all of these limited areas of review for the judiciary in the military, would that be redressable in our court?
So a couple points. The RIF board has a very limited set of documents in front of them, and I believe it's Air Force Instruction 36.2406 that actually go before, that's the evaluations that are included before the board. That's just the training report, which had this one line that said he received a letter of admonition for improperly addressing some legal staff. The full letter of admonition and the full email that he sent all the way to generals at the Pentagon was not included before the RIF board. And so that is not something, and again, they're not within his chain of command, so that's not something the RIF board could have possibly considered.
Wait, but they considered the fact. I mean, they've got to cut 30% of the workforce. They considered the fact that he had a letter of admonishment. I get law clerk applications all the time. There's a typo, that one's gone. You know, you got to weed these out somehow. You know, so what, I guess I don't understand your point about, well, they didn't read the actual letter. They only knew that he had a letter of admonishment. I guess I don't understand the import
right.
of that distinction.
I understood, Your Honor, and I was just responding to Chief Judge Prowse's hypothetical that he sent this, my chain of command isn't listening, and so I have to send this all the way up to the Pentagon, and there's this really serious, like a more proper whistleblower protected statement, and that had been, and that really irked some people because he went outside of the chain of command, and that was something that the RIF board had considered. And I'm saying even if that had been the case, that letter of admonishment would not have actually been in front of them. The email would not have been in front of them. What they have are these training reports.
Well, let's assume it was in front of them. Hypothetically, is there any recourse under those circumstances? How does the system work?
The Congress has made it very clear that the actual deliberations of these RIF boards are statutorily protected, cannot be disclosed, even in a discovery proceeding. I would refer the court to the statute at 10 U.S.
Didn't you just tell us what was in it and what was not in it?
Excuse me, Your Honor. So the actual documents that are provided to the RIF board, yes, are public, or at least provided to Major Crumley, and were included in the appendix. The deliberations, whether or not the RIF board actually looked at that and said, this guy is gone because he's got this letter of admonition on his record, that is something that is statutorily protected, cannot be disclosed. And that
right,
is.
But if a document on which the RIF board undisputedly relied can itself be challenged, then there is a possible remedy, which is send it back to whoever made the decision to discharge him and say, now that that document is no longer present, think about it again. There's no questioning of the initial RIF board's deliberations in that sequence of judicial steps.
So with 30% of the officer force being potentially reduced,
he might be discharged anyway.
He might have been discharged anyway, and that is exactly the point of the absolute discretion that is assigned to the military in their personnel decisions. And again, because of the specific congressional intent underlying the statute at 10 U.S.C. 613A. No, this is a statute that, and I have it in front of me here, Your Honor. It's called Non-Disclosure Board Proceedings, and it says the proceedings of the selection board convened under section so on and so forth applicable may not be disclosed to any person not a member of the board except as authorized or required to process the report of the board. This prohibition is a statutory exemption from disclosure as described in section 5.5.
I thought the scenario we were just talking about is one in which there has been no disclosure of the RIF board's proceedings, only that a document reporting the letter of admonishment was before the board. There's no disclosure of the proceedings, needed for we may otherwise not be able to, but there's no violation of that for the court to look at what underlay the letter of admonishment and decide if there was some legal impropriety in it.
Yes, they could underlay the letter of admonishment, which again the trial court found that there was substantial evidence for it. However, again, the injury, the actual something that is not justiciable, which is what we argued to the trial court, that even if they were to say, yes, this was improper, you should not have received this letter of admonishment, he wasn't separated and given, you know, a dishonorable discharge because of it. He was involuntarily separated under the statutory reduction in force with an honorable discharge. There's just nothing the court could do about it because as this court held in Murphy versus United States, the decision to retain service members is, quote, wholly to the discretion of the military. There's no vested interest in continued military service. And when he's discharged with an honorable status, there's nothing for the courts to do for him, unfortunately.
Can I just double check something with you?
Yes.
Our court has not held in any precedential decision that military whistleblower protection act claims are outside the Tucker Act when there is a Military Pay Act issue?
Yes. This court affirmed the Court of Federal Claims holding in Klingenschmidt in 2015 that found that there was the statute did not provide for judicial review. But
and the D.C. Circuit last year held almost necessarily that the district court had jurisdiction to hear a Military Whistleblower Protection Act claim because the D.C. Circuit said, we don't. So we have to decide whether to dismiss the appeal or transfer it. We're going to transfer it under the statute, the premise of which is that the transferee court has jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, although I would note that the standard for determining whether or not they actually made a protected statement under the Act is whether it was a substantial and specific danger to public health or safety. And as the trial court implicitly found by not granting or not finding jurisdiction over the Whistleblower Act claim, the email that was sent along to the Pentagon was specifically about something really bad happened to me. I'm really upset. I expect full and unrelenting Air Force support to this. It was not a disclosure that was about a huge issue to public safety. So even if the court were to find that it had that there was judicial remedy possible over that statute, it's not.
I don't understand. How can you say it wasn't related to public safety? He was in a cemetery. They had put AstroTurf over an open grave. Just AstroTurf. No boards. No dirt was underneath it. I mean, it's almost like something off of a cartoon where you step on something and you fall through a hole. I mean, I assume this was the cemetery's normal policy, but even if it wasn't, why isn't he reporting a substantial risk to public safety that these cemeteries are, in fact, doing this way, and we, the Honor Guard, are reporting to these cemeteries, and we have certain positions we're supposed to take next to a military casket for proper burial purposes, and we're never going to know whether we're stepping on a hole and falling in or not. I don't understand why you read his email as not disclosing a concern about public safety.
So I believe if you read the email, it's a one-time thing that happened. It's not that this is happening to service members all over the country or that it's a policy of the Cambridge Cemetery to always hide the tops of graves with AstroTurf so that it's not immediately visible whether or not there's a hole underneath there. It's the agency found that it was the agency to evaluated his argument and found that it was a one-time event that happened and that it was not a substantial and specific danger to public health. What the statute is looking for is something broader, something more far-reaching than just a one-time accident that occurred.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, I'm going to restore 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly in rebuttal, the government's points underscore why there is a need for discovery in this case before there's a ruling made on the administrative record. And in these cases of bias and pretext, the case law is clear that the court not need, and I believe the colorful language is the appellant need not show that they be both sinister and stupid, because typically a military commander's where they're acting on pretext, it's not going to be in the administrative record, which is why there's a need for discovery. We've met that threshold showing in this case, and that's exactly why there should be discovery. Now, on the issue of what is and is not discoverable, there's sort of two buckets, if you will. One bucket having to do with the initial actions that were taken against Major Crumley, what was and wasn't said, whether the commander's decisions were supported by a preponderance of the evidence, which is the required standard under the Air Force's own regulations. And then the second being this issue of the RIF board and their decision-making process. On the issue of the RIF board and their decision-making process, I think the government goes a little further than the statute does in terms of the privileges associated with it.
Is it your view that the non-justiciability of the RIF decision is not before this court, that unlike jurisdiction, that is a waivable issue and that the government has waived it here? Do you want me to say it again?
Yes, please.
Is it your view that unlike jurisdiction, which can't be waived, if we don't have jurisdiction, it doesn't matter whether she raises it or not. But below, not only do they argue no jurisdiction, they argued that RIF decisions made by the military are non-justiciable, which basically means you don't have the authority to review them. It amounts to almost the same thing as no jurisdiction. They made that argument below. They absolutely did not make it on appeal. Is it your position that that argument is waived and that therefore we do have the ability to look behind the RIF in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Is the right answer.
That is definitely the right answer. That's the right answer for your position.
Yes, and the right answer is as well as the AFBCMR decision. But yes, in short, Your Honor.
Right.
And I would submit that there should be further discovery here. And those records that the government refers to from the report, those are not in the record. Those were not provided to Mr. Crumley. And the only evidence that we actually have of what was said by 66th JAG office to Mr. Crumley in that phone call that allegedly took place, the counsel states what you can logically deduce was said in there, was that actually what happened, it's in Major Crumley's statement to the Inspector General, which is part of the record, is that Captain Peeler said, there's nothing we can do for you. It wasn't, we're here to help you or we'll provide you with assistance. It was, there's nothing we can do for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both sides in the cases submitted.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The next case for argument is 18.